This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
And welcome to another particularly wicked episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com.
Wicked, wicked, jungle is massive. Wicked, wicked.
Wicked episode. Do, 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 do. This is why we don't do remixes.
This is, no.
No. We should just do the regular mixes. We should do the cake mixes.
We should give them a taste of the remix.
The taste of the remix. It's hot and fresh out the kitchen.
Now, usually I don't do this, but
And we're rolling it out right now. I am Brian Salisbury. He is C. Robert Cargill. I am very sorry.
Together, we are Junk Food Cinema.
Form of bad taste. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening, despite what you may have heard in that intro. We are available, if you're interested, on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. If you want to go back past the 100-episode threshold that iTunes gives you, you can always check us out on Libsyn. That's libsyn.com for our entire catalog. If you like that stuff, go to iTunes, rate and review us. We want to move up that list as soon as possible. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/anyone?
Junk Food Cinema.
Cargill, how the hell are you?
I'm almost as tired as you are, my friend.
That is, I don't think that's possible, but I will take your word for it. It has been a while.
Well, for us, yes.
For us, it has been. Yeah, yeah, you're listening. You haven't missed a beat, but it's been a while.
We as we've mentioned in a couple. I know we definitely mentioned it in our Patreons, but we recorded a bunch of episodes together because somebody was going to have a baby, and then somebody went and had a fucking baby.
Spoiler alert. Had that baby.
You're so tired, it's wearing off on me.
It's just this general feeling of fatigue is just exuding into the room. It's like when you make cinnamon rolls in the morning and how it wakes everybody up. It's the opposite effect of that. Whatever is happening to me is sucking the energy out of everyone in the room. And I don't blame them. It makes perfect sense. But I'm excited to be back. I'm excited to be talking about movies and doing another stockpile of episodes so that maybe I can get some fucking sleep.
And we have a crazy one today. One that I'm actually really, really excited to talk about.
Oh my gosh. I have been kind of sidestepping this movie for a while. I've known about it. It's been in my periphery for a long time. But I never really thought that it would be in my wheelhouse because I, unfortunately, in my brain, not knowing anything about it, lumped it into a category of film that's just not really my thing. I kind of put it in the same categories like Practical Magic and all of these sort of like supernatural, for lack of a better term, chick flicks. Just not really my thing. But it is 1987. We are covering the best movies of that summer for summer
87. Notable films of 1987. Because when you say best after we did an episode on American Ninja 2, I just feel like we're liars.
I'm sorry. I don't know what movie that is. American Ninja 2. You're going to have
the
to be more
Confrontation?
Specific. Super Ninjas?
Fuck it.
Yes, that
there
one.
There it is.
That's the one. Yes.
There it is.
Yeah, so I was like, you put this on the list, and I thought, well, it seems like it's high time for me to finally watch this. So I sit down to watch it, and this is one of those great moments in junk food cinema history where I sit down to watch this movie, and the first thing that comes up on screen, a George Miller film. And I went, what the flying fuck?
Oh yeah.
Are you serious?
I know this movie is so weird in terms of not only what it is and how it came to be and who made it, but the fact that in 1987 this pop culture wise, this was fucking everywhere. This was one of those big, huge things of the summer. This was some of the biggest stars in the world making a movie. This is the new Jack Nicholson movie. It was weird. It was crazy. It was kind of obscene. It was a challenge to a lot of what was going on in the pop culture at the time. And it was just, it was ubiquitous. I mean, it was you just couldn't go anywhere without hearing about it. And then it vanished. It did not leave a pop a crater on the face of pop culture. It did, you know, there are no references that you see to it. There are no catchphrases that came out of that movie. As big a movie as it was, and as much as it was on the tip of everyone's tongue, it just kind of went away.
It receded from the collective consciousness like Jack Nicholson's hairline.
Yeah, and people realize it exists, and it's not like people are like, oh yeah, I completely forgot Witches of Eastwick was a thing.
In the quiet town of Eastwick, where nothing ever changes, three beautiful women are about to discover powers they never dreamed they had.
Who should we be looking for? He should be really handsome. Nice eyes.
Now, the man of their dreams is here.
Jane, at last we meet.
To stay for a spell.
Who are you?
Just your average horny little devil.
With the witches of Eastwick.
You know what's going on up in that house?
She says she sees the devil here in Eastwick.
If you were the devil, would you come to Eastwick?
Oh, I don't know.
Jack Nicholson, Cher, Susan Sarandon, Michelle Pfeiffer. The Witches of Eastwick.
But considering how much talent is attached to this movie, it is a movie that it astounds me that hasn't come up more. Like, it's never something, like when people talk about George Miller, no one ever talks about this movie. And it's such an interesting point in his career and an interesting highlight in a really fucking interesting career.
Now, I feel like I skated by something and kind of subtly referenced it, but I want to make sure that we really give it full attention. George Miller.
George fucking Miller.
This movie he makes 2 years after Beyond Thunderdome, the third in his fucking Mad Max trilogy. We're talking George Road Warrior Miller. George Mad Max Miller. Are you fucking kidding me?
And if that wasn't a big enough name, if that wasn't enough to go, this is interesting, it's adapted from a novel by John Updike.
I spent the entire opening credits of this movie going, hey, hold on. What?
Yeah, this is what astounds me. And the thing is, it's a great movie.
It really is.
So how does a great movie directed by George Miller, adapted from a novel by John Updike, with this fucking cast, just kind of be relegated to the shelf of history, to be like, kind of like, oh yeah, that was a movie. And that when you mention people like, oh yeah, nobody ever goes, oh my God, Witches of Eastwick. And they really should.
Oh, and let us not forget a score by John Williams.
Yeah. Let's just throw John Williams in there because there's not enough powerhouses in this movie. There's just not enough.
This feels like a group of people making a movie in the witness protection program because you have a bunch of filmmakers, a bunch of collaborators coming together on a project that doesn't feel in any of their respective wheelhouses, knocking it out of the park, and then a movie that, like you said, kind of just faded away. As much as it was a huge, huge pop culture phenomena, just vanished. And I can attest, and we'll get to it later, but this definitely was a pop culture phenomena just based on the number of times they tried to bring it back unsuccessfully.
Yeah.
They have gone to this well for television several times. And we'll talk about some of the people who were involved in some of those failed attempts to bring it to the small screen in just a moment. But I want to get to the plot of Witches of Eastwick because, as we've mentioned, it's based on a novel by John Updike. John Updike, who is considered one of the last true men of letter, and a great American novelist. I can't wrap my head completely around the fact that this is based on a book by John Updike.
Well, and as you delve into the film, you realize that it had to have been. Like, there's so much subtlety and nuance going on in a film like this. In a film being made by so many strong personalities. Like, that's the thing, is when you deal with people who are as powerful as these people were at this point, you've got George Miller at the height of his popularity and power in the 80s. You've got John Updike. You've got John Williams. You've got Jack Nicholson and Cher kind of anchoring this as the big powerhouses of the time.
Yeah.
Now, when you look at the cast in retrospect, it's kind of weird because at the time Cher was the huge star, and you look at the cast and you're like, she's with Susan Sarandon and Michelle Pfeiffer, a very young Michelle Pfeiffer, like, you know, who had not fully hit yet. Like, this is one of her big roles.
Just a few years after Scarface, in fact.
Yeah. That all of a sudden, you know, you look back at them and it is three of the greatest actresses of their day. And I guarantee you at the time, that's not how they were looking at it. Like, right. It was, they were looking for actresses who could keep up with and deliver the goods along with Cher. And instead they get three of the very best actresses of their era, period. And like, you go back and like, who is the most accomplished actress of that lot? That's an argument.
Yeah.
Like, you just, there's no one that stands out. And
it's an awkward bar fight is what you just said.
And then they're opposite fucking Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Right at the moment that Jack Nicholson is passing into being the older guy.
Am I too old to make this creepy yet? Yes, Jack. You're just old enough that this is creepy now. Thank you very much.
Well, but that's the beauty of the casting of them is they play that. Like, yeah. They don't shy away from that at all, unlike what you'd expect where it's like, oh, they're going to play Jack Nicholson up as sexy. No, right from the get-go, they play it as he's not supposed to be. It's that he knows exactly what to say and he's just charming enough to the right people at the right time that's what's attractive about him. But they hammer home that you're not supposed to think Jack Nicholson is hot.
Well, they have a line in the screenplay where Cher literally says to him, I think you're the most unattractive man I have ever seen. And she makes sure to list in his myriad flaws, you are physically repulsive.
Yeah.
So it's not like the movie wants you to think he's a sex symbol.
And they make a joke out of it, and it's great. And Jack Nicholson turns into the skid at every opportunity. And it's so great how he does it. The casting of this is fantastic. And while we're talking about the cast, we move on into the plot, how about young Richard Jenkins?
I was so excited to see his name in the credits.
I mean, not that he's one of those actors where it's like, was this guy ever young? Was no. there ever a fit young teen Richard Jenkins?
You find me a young Richard Jenkins, I will find you a James Tolkien with hair. These are two things that do not exist, my friend. They just aren't out there. And yes, I was as excited to see Richard Jenkins' name in the cast as I was John Williams. Also, Veronica Cartwright from fucking Aliens is in this. The powerhouse that people put together to make this movie is astounding. Not to mention the fact that it's produced by Gruber and Peters. Like, two of the most powerful men in Hollywood at this point. The two men responsible for getting the Batman movie off the fucking ground.
Yeah.
Tim Burton, 2 years after this movie. Yeah.
And yet, with all of this, this is like, there are people listening to this going, wait, who directed this? Wait, this is a John Williams score? Wait, who is in this movie?
Again, like,
this
is witness protection.
This is a movie that for some reason has just kind of been set aside and everybody remembers that it exists, but it's just sitting there forgotten, waiting to be pulled off the shelf and really, really enjoyed again. Because as weird a movie as this is, it's a wonderful movie.
It's great, but I feel like in the late 80s, at every video store in this country, you would walk in to rent it, and as soon as you brought back the tape, oh, did you enjoy Witches of Eastwick? Yeah, I sure did. Okay, cool. Look right here at this blue light. A kafoom, neuralized. Because fucking remembers it.
It's kind of like that bit at the beginning of the movie where nobody can remember his name. And they're like,
yes!
But you told it to me. I wrote it down. Why do I not remember his name?
It's absolutely a parallel running through this whole thing. Not to mention the fact that the basic plot of this movie, you have three women, Alexandra, Jane, and Suki, who are played by Cher, Susan Sarandon, and Michelle Pfeiffer, respectively, who at the beginning of this movie are all in a difficult place. They've have, one of them is a widow, one of them her husband has divorced her, one of them her husband has just run off. So they find themselves single, all three of them.
Well, and it's important to note that one of them is her husband divorced her because she was infertile, because yes. they couldn't have a family. Yes. And the other, the husband ran off with another woman because his wife was too fertile and kept popping out kids.
Yes. So not enough.
So they're all like all three of them are in odd places in their life where they're all unfulfilled.
And they start this movie in a way that and I will freely admit to my own prejudice here. This movie starts in exactly the way that I was hoping the entire movie wouldn't be. In my like the preconceived notion I had of this film was confirmed by the opening scene where it's just three women getting together, drinking wine, bitching about men. And I was like, if this is the entire movie, kind of feel like I know why I haven't seen this. But what happens from there is a mysterious stranger shows up in town buying an old mansion that has long been vacant in this small Rhode Island town. We should say a very waspy Rhode Island town.
Like oh.
The most uptight, white,
conservative.
Conservative, yeah.
Yes, and in fact, this is what's important about this opening, and we're skipping a very big point of what happens in the first few minutes of this movie, but what's important about the setting of this is that this is a very conservative town that it's all conservative on the surface. Like, you get this concept that it's not just a sleepy, quiet town, but all of these uptight, morally upright people are really kind of shitty people
as super judgmental, morally upright people tend to be. They're super shitty.
Yeah. And like one of our first encounters with these people is the guy who is the principal and maybe the mayor. It's never quite clear what exactly he is in the town, but who gives this really, really looking down its nose speech on morality and, you know, the fading morality of our times and the importance of morality of this small town, who, of course, is a married man who's who's making passes at all the other women in town.
Correct.
And it is, you know, and is being really gross about it. And this becomes one of the early jokes in the film. And as the movie goes on, the film is a critique on the 80s Reagan era conservatism. Like, it is very much a critique of all of these people who were hippies and were counterculture in the 60s and early 70s. And then just kind of as they hit their 40s, decided to become uptight, anal conservative, pain in the asses.
Yeah.
And this is at its heart a movie about feminism trying to exist in that culture. Like, that's really what this movie is about. And it's about the freedom of feminism. And it is about finding a place where you belong and how conservatism tries to squash that and tries to snuff that out. And this setting is very, very, very important to that. Like, every moment that we spend with these town folk, there's a few moments where it's really heavy-handed, but most of the time it's just this very subtle undercurrent of these are awful people who think they're great because of their morality, but right. They aren't really moral.
I feel like the character you're describing, who gives the speech at the commencement, is a lowercase g governor, like in the old sort of colonial days, when you're talking about a governor who was really just a guy who was a mouthpiece for the king. And was just a completely, you know, like somebody like Danforth in The Crucible.
Yeah.
Who is like, you not only are a political authority, but you also like carry the moral standard because you just decided to, because there's nobody to really challenge your power because you're imbued by the king and all that stuff. So I feel like that is, there's a lot of metaphor. There's a lot of kind of parallel in this movie to the actual days of, you know, the Salem witch trials, which is obviously not an accident. But what happens is, so this man who's shown up in town and bought this mansion, very mysterious, nobody can seem to remember his name. We eventually find out that his name is Daryl Van Horn, and he's played by Jack Nicholson. at his most greasy, the greasiest of greasy Jack Nicholsons that has ever greased.
Again, let's drive this home. I mean, this is...
Okay, let me try again. Greasiest. Was that better?
This is not a secret at all. Like, the movie is very straightforward about it.
He arrives during a thunderstorm under cover of darkness, accompanied, by the way, by actor Carol Strukin, who you only know as Lurch from the Addams Family movies.
No. No, you also know him as the Giant from Twin Peaks.
Who I only know as Lurch from the Addams Family.
Yeah. No, this is... No, but he is playing the devil. And he's doing a really interesting job as the devil. He's playing a very interesting iteration of the devil. Again, when was the last time when you've heard people talk about the greatest devil performances ever, anyone's mentioned Jack Nicholson?
See, and that's crazy because what I love about his devil performance is he's basically doing the Jonathan Pryce devil from Something Wicked This Way Comes, because he blows into town and his seduction method is not even sexual. His seduction method is that he gets into the head of these women, figures out what they want most in the world, plays upon their insecurities, and seduces them that way. It is fucking, you know, for lack of a better term, diabolical. It's so perfect.
And I think the genius of how he plays it is as the movie goes on, you find out that none of those things that he tells the women during the seduction are lies.
Right.
Like, ultimately, like, you would think, like, he talks about how much he wants children and he loves children. He does. Actually, that's kind of what he's up to. You know, when he talks about passion and letting out your passion and just being, that is also him. Like, as much as each of these, he becomes what each of these women want, because they summoned him, and we'll get into that in a moment, he already is all of those things. Like, he really is. The devil is a bit of what each of these women want and need, and what they're desiring. And the thing to him that makes him the devil is he knows exactly what to say in the moment to take you from loathing him to wanting nothing to do with him to being madly, passionately invested in him. And it is really interesting how it's written. It's really amazing how it's played. And it's believable.
Yeah.
It is a fantastic representation of the devil. It's really unlike, Jonathan Pryce is about as close as it gets. It's like that, and maybe, but the original Bedazzled is the closest you can get to this performance of the devil. And it's really, it's Jack at his full jackness. Like,
oh, he's jacking off all over this movie.
What's fun is I'm very curious about his performance in this movie because I almost feel like everything we know about Jack Nicholson in the pop culture after this movie, it's almost like he never stopped playing this character. Like, he just pulled out the glasses and,
you know, in future films, at Laker games, he just kept playing this role.
And that makes me curious how much of this devil was just George Miller going, Jack, I just want you to play Jack. Like, you just be you and read these lines. Or if
this role I've prepared for my whole life.
Yeah, there's so much Nicholson in this role. And he seems to be having a blast fucking doing it. Like, he seems to be having so much fun. But I'm just curious. It's so on the nose that it feels like he never stopped playing it. Like, I'm just reminded of the post Oscars a few years ago when Jennifer Lawrence had won and Jack Nicholson kind of sleazes his way up and hits on her and then goes off and she's like freaking out about it. And I'm just kind of like, that's Daryl Van Horn. Yep. Like, that's who that is right there. Like, that's the guy still around, still hitting on 22-year-old girls.
You talk about actors who are able to disappear into roles. I don't think Jack ever came back. He never
that was his Vietnam.
Like, yeah, exactly. As much
I never came back from Eastwick.
It would be like if you saw Daniel Day-Lewis today and he was still Lincoln. Like, you saw him at Spago and he's still sitting there giving like the Gettysburg Address.
That is exactly what
he just never came out. never care. And I love that. No, you're absolutely right. But one by one, these women kind of fall to him, and he sleeps with them. And it's, by the way, I love the not-so-subtle touch in this movie that you have Cher, Susan Sarandon, and Michelle Pfeiffer. So you literally have a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead.
Oh, yeah.
And he sleeps with all of them. And at first, there's jealousy between them. And it's communicated in this very odd tennis scene that represents, I shit you not, and this is crazy, the first time since A New Hope that Industrial Light and Magic and John Dykstra have worked together. This movie has so many people.
On a tennis match.
Are you kidding
me? Special effects on a tennis match.
This sounds like the episode that we did on Kazam where we were just making shit up as we went along. This is all true.
Making shit up. I don't know what you're talking about. Kazam is real.
It's a real movie and it was a real review and don't worry about it. This actually happened. Like, it's crazy to me that he came back after New Hope. He broke off from Industrial Light Magic, started his own company, and he came back to work with them for fucking this tennis match. It's insane to me.
In a George Miller movie.
In a George Miller movie, of all things.
Like, that's... let that sentence roll around your head for a minute. Okay, so here's an important thing that has been left out so far. At the beginning of the movie, we have the uptight principal who gives a speech, and it is one of those long, lingering speeches, and all three of the women are clearly just... they want to be somewhere else, and then from out of nowhere, a storm whips up and just starts pouring down and ruins the big speech. And everyone takes off. And they're talking about it later that night. It hasn't stopped raining. And at the same moment, they were all wishing something would happen so they could just get out of there. And, you know, the only person who thinks it's of any interest is Sookie, who thinks, don't you think that's weird? And it's just kind of nailing home that, yeah, we kind of did this. And then while they're sitting around drinking, they sit around and talk about what the perfect man would be and who they want. And everyone has something different that they want. But they all kind of come to consensus on what this one weird accumulation of things would make for the perfect man. And then Jack Nicholson shows up and he is,
hey, ladies,
ultimately all of them. He is all the things that they specifically asked for. And what he unlocks with them is they never actually use the word. Like, that's one of the weird things is they never refer to witchcraft. They never refer to themselves as witches. They never refer to what they're doing as magic, but they clearly are. And it becomes a movie that is very positive. I am in awe of the shape of this movie. The shape of this movie, how it's structured in a way that this is a movie in which we are happy for our protagonists to be seduced by the devil and what the devil unlocks in them. And the antagonists of the film are the people who can sense that something is very wrong and that these women have been seduced by evil, and then horrible things happen to them and you're okay with that as an audience member. Like, this movie's shape is so weird in how it portrays the seduction to evil that you are okay with it and you want to reject this 80s Reagan era conservatism. It's so bizarre and fascinating and fucking entertaining how this movie accomplishes that.
I want to say two things. One, go ahead and sheathe your tweets. I was wrong. It wasn't Dykstra. It was Industrial Light and Magic.
Oh. We pulled a boner and we're correcting a boner midway.
It's not so much a boner as we're doing two episodes again, and this is a connective tissue that will lead us into our next movie, on which John Dykstra did work with Industrial Light and Magic, so I just got my movies mixed up. But Industrial Light and Magic did do the entire tennis scene in this movie, which is, in and of itself, insane to me. As is who you find out did the effects at the end of this movie, which we'll get to. The other thing I want to say is that I had to watch this movie twice, because I got to the end of the first time, and I was like, what am I supposed to take away from this? Because if you are tracking it from the women's perspective and tracking it as a piece of feminist fiction, there are some really troubling moments.
Oh, yes.
Where you're like, are you actually trying to say that their lives are better for having given over to this man? That their lives are better for not being single? There's a lot of very old world sort of borderline misogynist ideas at the heart of their liberation that makes it hard to buy into. Now, once I'd seen it a couple of times and started delving into the book, the movie actually does a couple of very interesting things that makes me think that it is a little bit more liberated than on first viewing it may have appeared. First of all, we've talked about how they conjure Daryl Van Horn, about how that conversation at the beginning of the movie brings him about. They're not witches at the beginning of this movie.
No.
At all.
No,
there is no mention of them being a coven. There's no mention of special powers. They are just women getting together to have a bitch session.
Yeah, they get together Thursday night.
In the town of terror.
They get together on Thursday nights and drink and get away from the kids and just enjoy an evening with the three friends.
And it's also important to note that in the book, which takes place in the 60s, but was published in 1984, these women gain their powers. They don't have the. They are witches at the beginning of the story, but they don't gain their powers until their husbands either die or leave them. To me, that is the hugely, like, on the marquee feminist part about that is that they become more powerful without the men.
Yes.
I get that entirely.
How this movie presents it is they become more powerful only together.
Yes.
That together, as the three of them, they are powerful.
Which is why it becomes troubling throughout this movie when you realize they can't get out of his clutches and that it seems like they're happiest when they're all basically subjugating themselves to him.
And which, part of his harem.
Yeah, and it really blurs, like, I'm sorry, you said this was feminist? But then as the movie goes along and you see how they come to that realization themselves and that they need to get out from under his thumb and how they go about doing that, and the tenacity and determination that they show to do that, and then, of course, where they end up in their lives at the end of this movie, all very pro-feminist, for sure.
And we'll certainly spend more time on this in a little bit, but then Jack Nicholson's misogynistic speech in the church.
Women, a mistake? Or did he do it to us? On purpose.
Oh my God.
where he just goes full red pill. Like he is full MRA at the end of this movie. You're just like, holy shit, dude. Like we knew you were kind of full of it because you're the devil, but Jesus Christ, man.
He walks in the church like, now I hear they're doing a women's only screening.
Wonder Woman.
I'm super pissed about it. Me and my friends think it's... I've hired a lawyer.
My rights have been violated.
You know what? Fuck it. I can't do Nicholson. I'm just going to do Christian Slater.
This is so weird. Wait, this... You came into an episode with one of the easiest...
It's not easy!
One of the easiest impressions of all time, and you didn't prepare?
Yeah, the thing is, I can't do Nicholson, so I'll do the Nicholson Light, which is just... Christian Slater, he walks in, he's like, I don't like these women's only screenings. But actually, I want to talk about that because that is the capper, that scene that you're talking about, where he walks in and just basically lays out to the whole town how horrible women are, is the capper on some of the best physical comedy I have ever seen Jack Nicholson attempt or execute so well.
Okay, that's a point we really need to stress in this. The physical comedy in this movie... The performances in this movie. This movie doesn't have jokes. There are no jokes in this movie.
No.
But it's funny as fuck.
It is gallows humor to the nth degree. It pushes, in some cases, pushes the limits of dark humor where you're literally laughing at murder that's not played for... I mean, it's not silly. Nothing about this movie is silly. It is... You see people in extraordinary situations dealing with it the only way they know how... And you feel yourself empathizing with them to the point that you're laughing because it should be uncomfortable.
But Veronica Cartwright, for example.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God. She's the also at the end of what we mentioned, because when we say her name, you probably don't recognize her. But when you look her up, you're like, oh, shit, I know who she is. She's been in tons of things.
Yeah.
She steals the fucking show every scene she's
for
in.
Sure.
And when she falls down the stairs and from that point on becomes this howling evil conservative who senses that the devil and this great evil is in the house and knows that these women have become witches instinctively, but everyone just thinks she's nuts. She's fucking hilarious.
She should be called Goody Cartwright in this movie because she is definitely, if we're going again with our Crucible parallel, she's the Abigail. She is just calling everybody out. She's the one that sees evil everywhere. And I think one of the things that really helps you get on the side of, yeah, because it's, yes, Cher, Susan Sarandon, and Michelle Pfeiffer, they're living an atypical lifestyle because they're basically a harem for Jack Nicholson, all living under his roof in luxury and decadence and yada, yada, yada. But when you see how the rest of this town treats them for the very notion that they would all love the same man, you're kind of on their side. It's like, fuck this town, fuck their small-mindedness. I mean, she's at the grocery store. I think it's Susan Sarandon's at the grocery store, and someone behind her calls her a slut out loud. She's like, "What'd you say?" She's like, "You heard her." It's like they're not even hiding it.
And somebody else said, "You heard her."
Yeah.
Like it's like everybody feel like they're. This is, yeah, and this the ugliness of this town comes out, and Veronica Cartwright like epitomizes that. And what's so weird about that and so entertaining is she's absolutely 100% right. She is the character in every other 80s movie that's wrong about everything, that just doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. And no, she's 100% correct. What is going on in that place, in that mansion, is evil. Yeah. Like, it is, like, the devil is there and has corrupted these three women, and they are tapping into arcane powers and are truly happy about it. And she... what she does, her howling rants, and then ultimately when she starts being manipulated through voodoo and witchcraft, when she starts, you know, they're playing with her and she starts like vomiting, you get this scene of physical comedy that's genuinely funny.
Yeah,
like she is nailing it. Like there are several scenes of this that are just slapstick, but going to just the edge of slapstick and being funny in that way without going so fucking over the top that it is base and crude. Like it walks a very interesting line of being intellectual slapstick, and it's always funny throughout.
And you can't help but wonder who you're supposed to be rooting against. But on the one hand, you have this horribly judgmental, holier-than-thou town of assholes versus Jack Nicholson, who's, yes, who's Gracie, he's the devil, he's manipulative. He also allows Susan Sarandon to be a mother. You know what I mean? Like, and
he gives them all, you know, ultimately, you know, Sookie wants, that's one of the great undercurrents of this. Sookie wants a family, and Susan Sarandon wants to be a mother, and Cher just wants to feel part of something, wants to be part of a community. And they all get that. Like everyone gets what they really ultimately want and learn that they don't need a man to do it. And but it's never actually vocally said that way. It's just all thematic. Like it's so interesting about how the movie goes about delivering all of that to all of these characters without overselling it. Like it really is. There's so much fucking talent working on this movie, crafting it into something very subtle and delightful.
Yeah. And I want to go back for a second to what you said about this scene of the vomiting.
Oh yes. Which there are two. It's why you cued in when you talked about this great physical comedy of Jack Nicholson at the end.
Yeah. Well, it's a callback.
Yeah.
It's a upchuck and a callback. Because there's a scene in the movie, and this is where you start to realize where the lines of allegiance for the audience members really lie, because yes, Jack Nicholson is the devil, but these women aren't fully aware. Because as much as the book is written about three witches, these women are not witches. What happens is they end up gaining power through their companionship with Jack Nicholson. And at first, they don't even really understand that they have these powers, which is why you have this scene where Veronica Cartwright, who's been this horrible, judgmental wife in the town who's done nothing but scandalize them, and her husband runs the newspaper, and so he's writing an article about all this, Richard Jenkins. All of a sudden, there's a scene where just in very, you know, hedonism bot style, they're just sitting around eating these cherries and being in the pool and being very sexual with each other. And they keep spitting out the pits into this big gilded bowl. And every time they do it, you cut to Veronica Cartwright spitting up a cherry pit as she's writing this. She's writing something basically against these women. And these pits and these stems keep coming out of her mouth until eventually she just starts throwing up and projectile vomiting. And just, it is horrific to watch. Interestingly, they made initially a life-sized animatronic puppet of Veronica Cartwright for the cherry pit vomiting scene. But it would realistically thrash and convulse around so much that it made the scene too horrifying.
Oh my God.
And they cut it. But at the end of that scene, Richard Jenkins, who's convinced by this point that his wife's broken, she broke her leg earlier in the movie and that the bone marrow is getting into her brain and she's completely gone insane. He can't take it anymore and he kills her with a fucking poker from
the fireplace. He snaps and murders his own wife in a comedy.
In a comedy, but it's like the reason you don't hate the quote unquote witches for doing this, they have no idea that they're doing this.
No.
But that creates, it sows the seed, or the pit, I guess, if you will, for this scene later where Jack Nicholson is, the three women have finally decided they have to get rid of him, and they are using his own methods against him. They go to his library, they get his Necronomicon, which is not called the Necronomicon, but might as well be the Necronomicon, to come up with the spell, the
Maledictus or yes, something like that.
To come up with the spell to actually put him away, and they are poking this voodoo doll, and it's throwing up feathers and all these other things. So you have that. It becomes comedy. It becomes comedy because these terrible things are happening to characters we hate. And it really says a lot more about the audience watching it than it does about the characters in the movie, which is really fascinating to me. And by the way, we mentioned that Jack Nicholson is more of a Jonathan Pryce type devil. The tagline for this movie is Something Wicked This Way Comes, which is the name of the fucking movie based on the Ray Bradbury story in which Jonathan Pryce plays the devil. And it's amazing, and we'll have to cover it at some point. So definitely take a drink on that. But yeah, going back again to just this whole idea of this town and the oppressiveness and whether this is misogynistic or whether it's feminist, because John Updike was accused of being both. He was at certain points heralded as a great feminist and other points derided for being a misogynist.
Well, it's an interesting point my wife made when we watched it was how this is a great example of 80s feminism in that for the 80s, this is a very woke movie, for lack of a better term. But by these days' standards, these are feminist tropes, like of what people think feminist characters need to be, and they're actually kind of stereotypes at this point.
I call that shoulder pad feminism.
Yeah, that's exactly what that is a great phrase for it. Yeah, this is what this is. That this is a film that at the time was pretty open-minded about what it was being, and now as we look at it, we're like, well, I mean, its heart is in the right place, but these are kind of stereotypical characters that aren't really great feminist characters.
And what I mean by shoulder pad feminism, for those of you who weren't around for the movie Working Girl, is that it was a string of movies where women gained quote-unquote equality because they wore suits to work. Like, really, when you thought about in the grand scheme of these movies, not a lot was settled, but the ending scene had a woman in a suit with shoulder pads, and that's how you knew that everything was going to be on equal footing from that point forward, even though nothing really got solved and that characters didn't change that much. But it was like the packaging told you, and it was, you're right, the heart was in the right place, the effort was solid, but it didn't really have that punch. And what I find interesting about this movie, because I agree with you, is that the specific changes it makes from the book are a huge step forward for feminism compared to the book. Because in the book...
Let's just take a moment, because this is one of the points we need to stress. George Miller's a feminist? I find it's weird.
So getting back to the Imperiosis of Eastwick, which is what this movie is, because you're right. In the book, Nobody destroys Daryl Van Horn. The breaking point comes when Daryl Van Horn tries to marry the young daughter of who would be Richard Jenkins' character and Veronica Cartwright's character in this movie, and the three women get jealous and decide, well, they're fed up with him. That's kind of petty. Like, if that's the thing that finally makes them get out from under his thumb, that's a really petty inciting action for that. And in fact, they don't even destroy him. He just runs off with the younger brother of that girl, who he's also lovers with. So there's a little bit of a questionable condemnation of homosexuality in that. In the movie, the ending is these three women have decided that they cannot stand idly by and let this man completely corrupt who they are and turn them evil. So they take it upon themselves, get his spell book, you know, and really inflict a lot of supernatural damage upon him until he is destroyed in this really bizarre special effects sequence at the end of the movie.
Interesting.
It's very interesting. But you see what I'm saying? Like, it's the onus is far more upon them. They actually are the instrument.
Yeah, they have agency.
They actually are responsible for his destruction in the movie, whereas in the book, they just make him run away.
And kind of responsible for it, because he's not really destroyed.
There's a fucking Star Baby situation going on at the end of this movie that I'll freely admit I don't fully understand. You know, it's my 2001 moment. I'm like, I'm not sure what the fuck that means, but okay.
Oh, I actually really dig the final beat of this movie.
You may have to, not the final beat. I'm not talking about the thing on the television. I'm talking about, okay, we might as well get into it. Spoiler alert territory. Okay, so at the end of the movie, it becomes this huge battle of wills between Daryl Van Horn, who has been kicked to shit by the spells and incantations that the now, finally, witches of Eastwick, because they really weren't up until this point, have finally figured out how to do the spell and inflict the wounds upon him, and it just becomes this huge, like, people are flying around this mansion, and there's, you know, glass shattering and women flying into walls and Daryl Van
and they're
Horn.
Finally understanding their powers. Yes. And they're really grasping that.
So that leads to a version of Jack Nicholson that is this 3-story tall, fleshy nightmare. Something, you know what he looks like? Oh my God, I just realized what he looks like. He looks like something out of Dinipigen. He looks like one of the monsters from Dinipigen at the end of this movie. He's just this long, rubbery, evil-faced gorgon of a... If you thought Jack Nicholson was creepy as Jack Nicholson, wait till you see him as Jack Nicholson the gorgon, because it's horrific and will give you nightmares. They manage to destroy that, and he turns into a plant thing? He looks like one of those things in Harry Potter. A mandrake. He looks like a mandrake from Harry Potter at the end of this movie.
Well, he's just I mean, the thing is what they've done is they've created a wax voodoo doll of him. And as the voodoo doll gets broken and shattered and melted, he starts becoming deformed and his, you know, devil-like features are kind of taking over. But yeah, at the end, he's like, there's very little of him left. And he's just kind of this weird little mutant melted baby.
Okay, so we're not going any further into the explanation than that, because if it's just... it's weird and creepy looking. I got that. Believe me, I got that.
Oh, no, I was talking about the beat after that, like when he's gone. Yeah. I thought that's what you were talking about with Star Baby. No. Because this movie becomes a really interesting satire of 70s era, 60s and 70s era Rosemary's Baby, Devil Baby, that subgenre of movie, you know, the cult movie where we're ushering in the baby children of the devil. And like this movie ends with that on a light note. The devil had three wonderful little babies who are just adorable. And
it's still, I think the ending still shows that even though he's not completely gone and he still has influence in their lives, they are still making the active choice to resist him.
To shut him out.
So I totally get that. It was just really the weird mandrake root Jack Nicholson that I couldn't figure out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's George Miller going full George Miller. That's that whole ending climax is, this is where, like, up until this point, it doesn't feel like a George Miller movie. And at this point, you wouldn't put it together. Like, now in retrospect, when you watch The Road Warrior, you've watched Mad Max Fury Road, you've watched Babe Pig in the City, you know, you've seen some of his otter films. Witches of Eastwick makes sense, but it's not until this climax that he goes full George Miller and you're like, oh yeah, this is a George Miller movie. That's why we're going to have this shot where Jack Nicholson gets dragged across a city and then thrown into a church and then is going to be coughing up and cherry pits and vomiting cherry juice everywhere. And then they're going to have this big fight in the house and he's become this big mutant fuck. Like, of course he is. Like,
I just remember... I sat down to watch this with my fiance, and she had seen it before, and she's like, that movie's fucked up. I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, cherries. I'm like, I don't know what that... She goes, just cherries. And I was like, okay. And then I get to this scene where they put a big dish of cherries in front of the witches, and I'm like, okay. And then as that scene goes on, I'm just like, holy fuck. Yeah. Ugh. No, I get it. By the way, that big, church-sized version... of Jack Nicholson that we've been talking about, the rubbery monster version of Jack Nicholson. You know who put together that rubbery monster version of Jack Nicholson?
Who?
Rob Bottin.
Well, of course. Of course. It was the 80s.
Of course Rob Bottin and Industrial Light and Magic and John Williams or George Miller all involved in this movie. How the fuck did I go this long without seeing a movie that has those? If you had sat me down and said, I'm going to show you a George Miller movie that John Williams did the score for, that is based on a John Updike novel, Rob Bottin did the effects, I would be like, okay, fuck it. How have I not seen this? Show it to me right now. This movie is so much more than its cast. Its cast is amazing, but when it all comes together, it is just, it's like all of these people you would never expect to do a movie like this excelling at doing a movie like this. And speaking of excelling, this movie, yes, like you said, was huge in pop culture. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And I wanted to talk about the fact that after this movie came out, there were a number of attempts to actually bring this to the small screen. So the first one I want to mention, there was a 1992 made-for-TV remake of The Witches of Eastwick, directed by Rick Rosenthal. Rick Rosenthal of Halloween 2 fame, starring as one of the three witches, as Suki, Catherine Mary Stewart of The Apple and Night of the Comet and a number of other 80s movies that
we love.
Yeah. So, and that is, by the way, welcome to the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, no.
Because from there, so that's the 1992 remake, made-for-TV remake. In 2002, there is a TV movie called Eastwick. And the TV movie is basically just a continuation of The Witches of Eastwick, but stars Marcia Cross, Kelly Rutherford, and Lori Loughlin as the three witches. But more notably... is that in 2002, it also starred Chris Evans. Captain America himself was in this 2002 TV update of The Witches of Eastwick. Again, we're moving down the iceberg. From there, there is a TV series in 2009 based on the film that is also just called Eastwick. So they've made...
Keep in mind, 22 years after this movie had come out, yeah, they were still making TV movies based
absolutely
on this.
No reason in hell to try this again. So and keep in mind that the 1992 TV movie was just a remake. Eastwick was a TV movie that was like a continuation, but not really changing too much. And then this 2009 TV series is just a TV show based on... They're not really trying to propel much forward. They're just trying to cash in. But what I love about this version of Eastwick in 2009 is... It not only Veronica Cartwright comes back as a different character, hilariously. It also has Rebecca Romijn and John Bernthal. The fucking Punisher is in this version. So you have Captain America in one version and the Punisher in another. The fuck, guys? Like, the lineage of ways they tried to relaunch the Witches of Eastwick is crazy.
Oh, wait. You know what? If we're gonna be talking about superheroes that appear in these various movies, we have to mention that Catwoman is in the original.
This is true. And that may be because it was produced by John Peters, who, by the way, if you guys haven't heard Kevin Smith's good story about John Peters trying to put a giant spider in a Superman movie and then it shows up in Wild Wild West, apparently George Miller butted heads with John Peters because John Peters had the brilliant... But John Peters is fucking cuckoo bananas, by the way. If you don't know this about the guy, he's fucking insane. If you took Roger Corman and rolled him up with Menachem Golan and rolled that up with, I don't know, fucking Cecil B. DeMille. Like, roll all these crazy producers up and you won't touch a tenth of the crazy that is John Peters. John Peters comes to George Miller in the middle of shooting and says, I want aliens in this. What? Why? What? There's the book had nothing to do with aliens. It's called The Witches of Eastwick. There was literally nothing extraterrestrial about this fucking story. John Peters just gets a hair up his ass. I want aliens in this movie. Which might be, and this is just a theory I'm throwing out there, might be how Rob Bottin ends up on this movie as a compromise. George Miller going, Rob Bottin makes great aliens. We'll bring him on. And then somehow, in the process of making the movie, convinced John Peters that the crazy two-story Jack Nicholson Demigorgon maybe, is in fact an alien.
Wait, okay, so you got all wound up and got ready for a John Peters rant about trying to put aliens in it, and the mutant little melted star baby at the end seems weird now?
It doesn't seem as weird now.
Yeah, now it's kind of making this is. I mean, this is how the giant spider fucking ended up in Wild Wild West. Like, man. This is that.
Let me just say it.
Oh, here's a story from the vault.
Dun, 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 dun.
I'm going to for those of you long time listeners, I'm going to drop a little name.
Beware of falling names. Beware of falling names.
Beware of falling names. No, this is and literally at this point, the story I'm about to tell, this has got to be 18, 19 years ago. This is 1999. And I am at a local con called Armadillo Con, which we'll be at later this year, actually. Here in Austin. And I end up through a series of events in a bar with Neil Gaiman. And so me and Neil Gaiman start talking, and he had just gotten to Hollywood. He was just like, he was writing screenplays, he was pitching stuff, and he was very excited about it. And so he wanted to talk about it, but a lot of the names he was throwing around, most of the other people at the, you know, they were writers or readers and didn't really know, you know, they weren't deep in Hollywood. So when he talks about the fact that he was, you know, he had just had a meeting with various folks, the name suddenly eluded Darren Aronofsky. Like, everyone's like, who? And I'm like, oh yeah, the guy who did Pie. And he's like, yes. So we start talking and I'm like, dude, what is going on with Sandman? Is that ever going to get made? And he goes, well, Cargill, have you seen Wild Wild West?
Oh no.
And I said,
oh no.
Yes.
Oh, no.
And he goes, those are the people producing it. And I was like, oh my God. And he goes, he's like, so you've seen it? I said, yeah, I saw it in a few weeks or a few months back. And he goes, I had to get on the phone with John Peters and tell him what I thought of his movie. And I'm like, and so he went on trying to describe how, so imagine Neil Gaiman trying to preserve a relationship with John Peters while explaining to him what he felt about Wild Wild West as diplomatically and as Neil Gaiman-y as possible. And it is an unreal idea of a phone conversation that I cannot even, like, you cannot duplicate. Like, it's but
Mr. Peters, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm really excited that you're going to be turning my work, I mean, it's something I'm very passionate about, Sandman into a movie. Yes, Neil! But here's the thing. Instead of a Sandman, he's going to be a Sand Spider!
So,
Hang up the phone.
So why didn't
hang up the phone.
For those of you that ever wondered why Sandman never got off the ground in the 90s?
Because it's really hard to pick a giant Sand Spider up off the ground. As it turns out, anyone, and I don't care if this sounds like I'm generalizing, and if it offends anyone, I don't care. If you got your start in Hollywood being an actress's hairdresser, you should not be producing movies. Except that if it weren't for John Peters.
The thing is, to say what you will.
I do, typically.
He produced a number of important and, I would even argue, great movies, in addition to the ones that weren't.
I feel
either.
Like the best movies he produced, very much like George Lucas, are the ones on which people were able to tell him no. Like, apparently Nicholson and George Miller had to walk off the set for a day until John Peters let go of the alien fixation. John Peters brought an actor to set dressed as an alien to try and force the issue. And George Miller and Jack Nicholson were like, fuck that.
Oh,
and they walked off the set. This man is dangerously insane.
Hocus pocus.
And speaking of dangerously insane, we've made it to the junk food pairing, which I feel like chocolate-covered cherries has to be the fucking junk food pairing of this movie. Stuff a bunch of them in your mouth, wait until they melt, and then see if you can make it through the Veronica Cartwright vomiting scene of this. Oh man, I was
just chasing down cherry pie on that one. I was just like, you know, the nice, and frankly, honestly, I think to really tie it all together, cherry pie with a nice scoop of vanilla ice cream. Because of the whole ice cream bit at the end of the movie, I think.
Oh, you know what? If we're gonna mix cherries and ice cream, cherries jubilee. That's what we gotta go with, right? If you're gonna mix cherries and ice cream for the junk food pairing, which you're right, both of which feature prominently into the movie, it's cherries jubilee.
There we go. We've got it, and we have a consensus.
We have an accord. Huzzah! Huzzah! Thank you so much for joining us on this episode, Witches of Eastwick. Summer of 87 burns brightly and continues on, and we're very excited to keep going with some... Man, we've got some locked and loaded titles that I am super excited to talk about.
And we have a couple titles that you've never seen that I'm really excited for you to watch. Yeah. Like this is
Witches of Eastwick.
This is part of the... Like this Summer of 87 is such a big deal for me because it was the... I haven't talked about this yet, but it is the first summer where my parents were kind of like, yeah, he's old enough. We've shown him rated R movies before, but now he can go to the movies on his own. Like, as long as we haven't heard anything absurd about it, he can go see it. So my parents, this is the summer that my parents just kind of went nuts and either took me to crazy shit or let me go see crazy shit on my own. So I saw... This is the first summer that I saw most of this stuff in a theater. And my first memory of Witches of Eastwick was being at another double feature, which we'll talk about next month. We're doing that episode as a double feature. And we're going to have a special guest for that double feature too. That double feature is going to be great. But I remember being at a drive-in movie theater watching this double feature and looking over on the screen next to me, and it was the finale sequence of Witches of Eastwick. And that was the first time seeing it. I was like, I got to see this crazy movie, and would later see it on HBO. Because that was, my parents were like, oh, that's a sex movie. You're not allowed to see it. Of course, I waited until they went to bed and watched it. And it's like, this isn't a sex. There's no sex in this movie. 13-year-old me was a slight bit disappointed. This is a really amazing summer. And this movie, I'm so glad you enjoyed this movie. I'm so glad you took to it. And my wife had never seen it. I hadn't seen it since I was a kid. I really fell madly back in love with this movie. And I hope if you haven't seen it that you enjoy it as well. We've rekindled your interest in rewatching it, please do, because dear God, George Miller, guys, fucking George Miller.
First American movie, by the way.
You know what? We mentioned the name. We did not mention how fun and delightful John Williams' score is in this movie.
It is,
like, we talked about him doing
John Williams, but it's very, very, very good.
It's really good. Yeah, no, it's when you hear it, it's like, of course, it's like a James Horner score where it's like, of course, this is John Williams.
Actually, funny enough, when I first heard it, I thought it was Danny Elfman. Like, the first few strains in this movie, when the wind is changing and they're in this little town and the credits are rolling, I was like, not only did I get Danny Elfman vibe from it, but it made the whole town feel very much like the town from Beetlejuice. And then it was like, John Williams? Seriously?
Yeah.
And yeah, no, he definitely, he's there's a reason he's a master, for sure. Yeah.
But now we're done with the episode.
We're done with the episode. Unless you would like to become a patron, which we highly recommend, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Help us keep the lights on. Help keep my son Zane in diapers. All of that good stuff. We will kick you bonus content that only the patrons get to hear for as little as $4 a month. We've gotten a lot of new patrons recently. We really do appreciate that. We have got some mailbags. We've got some more junk food a la modes.
Yeah, well, for those of you that don't know what a junk food a la mode is, it's us doing this, but for movies that are out now.
Yeah. Movies that we think are junk food worthy that are currently in theaters. We also have Summer of 77, a whole secondary series running right under Summer of 87.
Talking about all the great movies that came out 10 years before 87.
For sure. So definitely jump on that as well. But I'm going to go ahead and in this episode reminding you that men are such cocksuckers, aren't they?
Oh, I don't know.